Good morning. On today's programme, living under surveillance and the threat of violence in Jerusalem, and the UK's plan to repurpose telephone cable boxes to charge electric cars. But first we go to India, where Prime Minister Narendra Modi this week opened a Hindu temple, controversially built on the site of a mosque, until its demolition in 1992 by a mob. The consecration of the temple may have played well with Mr. Modi's supporters, but his critics say India's leader is flouting the country's secular constitutional principles, and the move heralds a descent to a theocracy like its neighbour Pakistan. From India, Sajida Momin reports.
By all accounts, India has just witnessed the biggest spectacle since its independence in 1947 from British colonial rule. Earlier this week, Prime Minister Narendra Modi inaugurated a grand new temple in the holy city of Ayodhya in North India, dedicated to God Ram, who is worshipped by millions of Hindus in India and abroad. But this temple is much more than a mere place of worship. It is at the intersection of religion and raw political power. The temple's dramatic launch amid unprecedented fanfare brought the world's most populated country to a standstill, with more than a billion people glued to their television sets. And to get into Modi's good books, some of India's most powerful and influential personalities, like industrialist Mukesh Ambani and Gautam Adani, Bollywood superstar Amitabh Bachchan, and cricket legend Sachin Tendulkar, turned up for the inauguration. As many as 80 chartered flights landed at the brand new international airport in Ayodhya for the temple's opening. The airport, however, couldn't house so many private jets, so they had to depart immediately after dropping the dignitaries. India has a secular constitution which draws a line between religion and the state. But Modi blurred the distinction and consecrated the new temple as a Hindu high priest would. He even prostrated himself before the most popular deity in the Hindu pantheon. In the bargain, he burnished his credentials as the foremost devotee of Hindu religion's foremost god, Lord Rama, with an eye on the political and electoral dividends in the general election in a few months' time. Although India is predominantly Hindu, no prime minister before Modi wore his Hindu religion on his sleeve like Modi. Importantly, Modi even publicised that he observed several religious rituals before the January 22nd consecration, like fasting for 11 days on coconut water, sleeping on the floor on just a blanket, and reciting the scriptures at night. According to ancient Hindu texts, he was also required not to tell any lies and speak only the truth during those auspicious 11 days before the consecration. The last requirement especially left his legions of detractors smirking and sniggering. Spread over nearly 3 hectares or 7.4 acres, the temple, which is still being built, has an estimated cost of $217 million. It is made with pink sandstone, adorned with intricate carvings, and has 46 doors, 42 of which will have a layer of gold. Anil Mishra, a member of the trust overseeing the construction, said the temple blends traditional design with cutting-edge technology and is crafted without the use of iron, steel or cement, making it an architectural marvel of sorts. But the new temple is marred by multiple controversies. Firstly, it is only partially built, which led India's four top Hindu religious leaders, called Sankracharyas, to criticise and boycott the inauguration. Modi clearly opened the under-construction temple to consolidate Hindu voters behind his Hindu First Bharatiya Janata Party in the upcoming general election. The inauguration of the partially built Ram Temple in Ayodhya is being rightly seen as his trump card to become the Prime Minister for a third straight term, equal to the record of India's first Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, who belonged to the Congress Party. After the inauguration, Modi's re-election is a certainty. Secondly, the new temple has been built where the Babri Mosque stood until December 6, 1992, when it was demolished in broad daylight by a mob led by heavyweights belonging to Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party. Hindu hardliners claim that the mosque was built in 1527 by Mughal Emperor Babur after destroying a temple at Ram's birthplace in Ayodhya. BJP election manifestos had been promising for decades to rebuild the Ram temple. In 2020, the Supreme Court ruled that the Babri Mosque was illegally pulled down, but still handed over the land to Hindus to build a temple. The apex court's verdict was roundly criticized for its majoritarian thrust, but to no avail. The judges who ruled in favor of Hindus in the Ram temple were especially invited to the inauguration to acknowledge their contribution. Opposition parties, however, turned down the BJP's invitation to the grand opening, saying that the temple is not inspired by religious beliefs, but has been built solely to divide India along Hindu-Muslim lines in order to perpetuate BJP rule. India is 80% Hindu, but it is also home to 200 million Muslims, who the BJP doesn't count among its voters. Modi's critics say with a lot of conviction that the entire Ram temple is a political project and accuse him of orchestrating the inauguration to win the coming elections by pandering to Hindu religious sentiments. For World Report, I am Sajida Momin in India.
Next, we go to Israel, and as a war which has claimed 26,000 lives continues to be waged in Gaza, in Jerusalem's Old City, residents, the majority of whom are Palestinian, live their lives under constant surveillance. And, as Hannah McCarthy reports, they're also living in an air of paranoia and suspicion, with sporadic incidents of violence.
After thudding down a dozen stone steps and through the Arch of Damascus Gate, the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem's Old City reveals itself. Fresh bread, sweets, raw meat, leather, soap, incense and burning oil. All these smells waft from the narrow cobbled streets and winding alleyways. The wheels of small motorised carts and electric scooters zip over centuries-old pathways and by some of the holiest sites in Christianity, Islam and Judaism. This is where Jesus and the prophets Abraham, David and Solomon once lived, while the holy city was linked with Mecca by the night journey of the prophet Muhammad, whose cousin Ibn Abbas said, "There is not an inch in Jerusalem where a prophet has not prayed or an angel has not stood." While angels may still be standing watch today, they could well be outnumbered by the 400 CCTV cameras that have been installed by Israel to watch over local residents. Today, the majority of the 35,000 people living within the city's walls are Palestinian, living below the poverty line and under 30. Despite the youthful population, this is no place for young men and boys if they're Palestinian. As I walk by the end of the Via Della Rosa, the route where Jesus is said to have carried his cross to Calvary, I pass by a dozen Israeli soldiers crowded around a Palestinian teenager being body searched against a wall. A soldier, probably 19 or 20 years old, kicks the boy's leg wider. Another soldier notices me watching. She walks towards me and screams, "Where are you from?" Jerusalem is ethnically diverse, and Jerusalemites often ethnically ambiguous. It's not always clear who is Israeli, Palestinian, Christian, Muslim or Jewish. So it's not uncommon for someone in the Old City to ask a stranger a probing question, like, "Where are you from?" to see if they found an appropriate recipient for their prejudice or favour. Sadly, sometimes a uniform, a hijab or a kippah is the only cue an assailant needs to make a deadly attack on another. A soldier checked my bag one morning before I walked through Herod's Gate. An hour before, a 16-year-old boy from East Jerusalem stabbed a police officer there in the neck. The boy was shot dead moments later, while the woman died in hospital shortly after. Itamar Ben-Gvir, Israel's far-right national security minister, soon arrived on the scene and said the authorities were working to demolish the boy's family home as soon as possible. At a nearby cafe, the owner served fresh pomegranate juice and sighed talking about the attacks. He spoke as someone both used to them and who expected them to happen again. It's a pressure cooker here. In theory, the Old City should be a web of closely knit communities, but instead, an air of paranoia and suspicion often reigns. One Jerusalemite described his home as a city of spies and torture. As I sit outside a cafe at the new gate entrance that leads to the Christian quarter, an acquaintance points at a man walking by. He's a Palestinian who works for the Shin Bet, the Israeli secret police. He carries two pistols on him at all times, the acquaintance says knowingly. The Israeli authorities have a web of informants among Palestinians and the Old City's residents. Some were arrested and offered less jail time, others a business permit or money, or some simply the chance to stay living in their home city. Palestinians living in Jerusalem are residents, not Israeli citizens, and their permission to live there can be all too easily rescinded. In recent years, the Holy City has become notorious for murky property deals and court cases that are slowly eroding the character of Jerusalem's distinctive neighbourhoods as Israeli settlers seek to evict or buy homes from Christian and Muslim residents. Some of these residents are willing to enter into lucrative deals as a way out of poverty. Some are tricked into selling to settlers who use murky corporate structures and frontmen to hide their true identities and intentions. While some of Jerusalem's religious leaders have been all too willing to sideline their congregations for a healthy return on church property that's caught the interest of radical Israeli settlers. Shortly after Christmas, a group of Armenian priests and local residents found themselves fighting off 30 extremist settlers who, dressed in ski masks and armed with various weapons, were trying to intimidate the Armenian Christians from their land, which seems anything but holy now. For World Report, I'm Hannah McCarthy in Jerusalem.
Finally, to the United Kingdom. Green boxes containing telephone cables have been a familiar sight on the streets of the UK for decades, but they may have a new use as charging points for electric vehicles in the future. The plan by British Telecom to convert the iconic roadside cabinets to be used to charge EVs comes as sales of electric cars has stalled in the UK. The British government is also backing a scheme to allow motorists to make money from the power stored in the battery of their car by feeding it back into the electricity grid. Russell Padmore reports from London.
For more than 100 years, the British telephone system has used green cabinets on streets to route copper cables between the exchange and people's homes. Today, the roadside boxes also have wires for internet connections. The UK telecom giant BT looks after 110,000 green cabinets and 192 million kilometres of cables. But as copper cables are being replaced with fibre optic ones, enabling phone calls to be routed over the internet, a small network means many cabinets may become redundant. BT is piloting a new use for the green cabinets, as points to charge electric vehicles. The first one has been switched on in Scotland, in East Lothian. If successful, it will certainly go a long way to deal with a shortage of places to charge an EV, which deters car owners here from going electric. The project plans to eventually retrofit 60,000 of the curbside boxes. BT says its own research suggests more than a third of drivers would already own an electric car if charging was less of a challenge. The infrastructure will have to be improved significantly if the UK is to achieve its goal of phasing out sales of new diesel and petrol-powered cars by 2035. A few months ago, the government decided to delay its ban on new diesel and petrol cars and vans by 5 years. The revised policy caused dismay in the automotive industry, which has spent billions on efforts to meet the 2030 targets. At the end of December, the UK had almost 54,000 charging points, according to ZapMap, an online service that guides drivers to places to recharge their vehicle. Compare that figure of 54,000 chargers with the 300,000 the government here wants working within a few years, and you can see why car buyers are concerned. 2023 should have been a good year for sales of electric vehicles, but according to the Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders, EVs accounted for just 16.6% of sales, the first year since 2016 that the share of the overall market failed to improve. It prompted calls for tax cuts to encourage motorists to go electric. If tens of thousands of green roadside telephone cable cabinets are retrofitted to charge cars, it would certainly improve the network infrastructure. Range remains a concern for future and current electric car owners, especially those who can't install a charging point at home. The UK is also pushing ahead with a way to provide a financial incentive for owners of electric cars, encouraging them to make money from the power stored in their vehicle's battery. Bidirectional technology allows the unused electricity stored in the battery to be fed back into the power grid. Electricity bought during a period of peak demand is more expensive. So if cars are charged off-peak, when electricity is cheaper, that same power can be sold back to the grid at a time of peak demand when electricity is more expensive. The driver makes a profit from their EV. Bidirectional charge cars proved very useful in 2019 in Japan, when a powerful typhoon damaged the power grid in the Kanto region, causing blackouts. Electric vehicles built by Toyota, Nissan and Mitsubishi supplied electricity to support the local grid. It seems like a nice earner for owners of electric vehicles to charge their EV when power is cheaper and then sell it back when it's more expensive at peak demand. But the bidirectional technology is more expensive than cars with a one-way flow charging system. And so far, automotive companies are only fitting it to a few of their electric models. BMW, Volvo and Porsche are testing it, and Tesla plans to incorporate it into their cars next year. When you add the fact that not all charging stations support bidirectional technology, then the system is very limited. Which drives me back to the conversion of those iconic, curbside green telephone cable cabinets into EV charging points. BT's trial is in its very early stages here, and it's uncertain when or if the two-way flow of electricity, bidirectional technology, will feature in its plans. This is Russell Padmore for World Report in London.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.